Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Today's business leaders are saying that sustainability and diversity metrics are key to the way they do business. But what does that look like in practice? Stick around until the end of this episode to hear more.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point. President Trump declared border wall negotiations with a congressional committee a waste of time and said he'll build the wall on his own.
I'm not waiting for this committee. And I've told a lot of people I don't expect much coming out of the committee because I keep hearing the words that we'll give you what you want, but we're not going to give you a wall. And the problem is, if they don't give us a wall, it doesn't work.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell leads the rebuke of President Trump's withdrawal plans in Afghanistan and Syria.
ISIS and Al-Qaeda have yet to be defeated, and American national security interests require continued commitment to our missions.
And a deadly polar vortex froze the Midwest. A woman in Chicago braved the outdoors.
It's so cold. Anything that's exposed, any exposed skin, that's what's terrible.
Join us. Do you think these negotiations over the wall are a waste of time? Are you okay with the president declaring a national emergency to get it done? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook, where they're at On Point Radio. With me this hour from Washington, Julie Mason, host of The Press Pool on SiriusXM's POTUS channel. Julie, great to have you with us. Thanks.
Hello, Jane. Thanks for having me.
Joining me from New York City, Caitlin Huey Burns, political reporter for CBS News. She appears on the streaming network CBSN. And you can read her work on CBSNews.com. Caitlin, great to have you.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Welcome, Jack.
Hello, Jane, Julie, and Caitlin.
So we'll start with President Trump. He says he's all but given up on negotiations with Congress over his border wall. Julie Mason, president says he will build it on his own,
right.
Suggesting he will declare a national emergency to get it done. What do you make of it?
Yeah, it seems like he's been edging towards that for a very long time. This pre-buttal of the conferees is interesting, but he seems so removed from the process. He's so excluded from it, watching it a la distance. But his remarks to the New York Times were very interesting and I think very instructive because it's felt for a long time that we're heading in that direction, the emergency direction.
Here's part of that interview with the New York Times with reporters Peter Baker and Maggie Haberman in the Oval Office yesterday. President Trump discussing his plans to move forward with these negotiations for border security.
I think I've set the table very nicely. I think people understand. Well, they understand, Peter. They didn't know what was going on in the southern border. Now they know. They had no idea the amount of crime, the amount of drugs, the amount of human trafficking, which can be stopped with a proper system.
You set the table for an emergency declaration.
I've set the table. I've set the stage for doing what I'm going to do.
Are you going to wait out the 21 days before you take it?
Yeah, I'm going to wait till the 15th. I think it's a waste of time.
I've set the table. I've set the stage for doing what I'm going to do. Caitlin Huey Burns, building this border wall was the president's, really, his most tangible campaign promise, and appears he's finding a way to deliver it.
Delivering it through executive order, if you will, by aiming to declare an emergency. But it's also really a concession that he knows that he can't get this out of Congress. We already went through the shutdown, and he's already seen the negative impact that had, not only on the workforce, but on his own ratings. CBS News polling showed that 47% say that Pelosi was doing a better job on negotiating over the shutdown than Trump was. And so he certainly has seen those headlines and knows that he can't get this from Congress, a Congress that includes a Republican majority in the Senate, but of course Democrats control the House. What's really going to be interesting, though, is what kind of legal challenges this would expose the president to. And Democrats have already said that they would follow those through.
So, what about those legal challenges, Julie? Real?
Oh, sure, they're real, and not just from the Democrats. I think all and sundry are going to be coming forward to sue over this and tie it up in the courts, which kind of it works to the president's advantage in a way because then he can blame everyone else, and it's not on him. It's not his responsibility anymore.
Here's Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House, rejecting the idea of appropriating funds for President Trump's border wall. This was at her weekly press conference yesterday.
There's not going to be any wall money in the legislation. The However, if they have some suggestions about certain localities where technology, some infrastructure, as I said, about the ports of entry, we might need more ports of entry. We might need some roads. That's part of the negotiation.
Part of the negotiation, Jack Beatty. I mean, the Democrats were not going to give Trump this wall. They just were not.
No, and they seem to have racked up a victory, to judge by the public opinion polls. Or to put it another way, the president has harmed himself. Rarely in American politics has one seen such rapid self-subversion. 8 points in one poll since December, the president has lost. According to a recent poll, a third of Republican voters would be open to seeing a primary challenge to the president. I'm just looking at an item from a Utah paper saying half of Utah Republicans, people in Utah, would be want to vote for someone else if they can. Mm-hmm. Utah, which hasn't gone Democratic since 1964, the president has invited this. This is something he has done to himself. I mean, the State of the Union, you could argue, is really sound. The economy is purring along. Peace talks are moving along in Afghanistan. Peace, or at least perhaps peace and prosperity. And yet, because of the president's decisions, not just this, but the trade war and other things, the state of the presidency is shaky indeed.
Let me get Jared in here from Dothan, Alabama. Hi, Jared. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
What do you think about this? Are you for President Trump declaring a national emergency to get his wall?
Absolutely not. I think it's absurd. And really, he has no right to do that at this time. There's no legal recourse for it. I don't understand how they aren't trying to just put a stop to everything he's doing, really. But focusing on this, he has already shut down the government for X amount of time, and now he wants to do it again in 3 weeks. He doesn't care what happens to the everyday people.
Well, it sounds like he doesn't want to shut down the government. Jared, Julie Mason, what do you make of it? I mean, I don't think there is an appetite for another government shutdown for sure, and the president
no.
maybe sensed that. Yeah,
it's amazing, Jane, when you think about it. No appetite for a government shutdown, no appetite for an emergency declaration, no appetite for a wall at the border, and yet the president persists. He is still serving this sliver of the country that is his base that he feels very strongly about, but it's unpopular policy moves in support of an unpopular policy. It's hard to fathom.
Caitlin Huey Burns, I mean, the president had control of both chambers of Congress for 2 years and no wall. And I guess now we're at this point. We have a national emergency. February 15th is the deadline for these negotiations. Can the president declare a national emergency before that point and, you know, start the ball rolling on this?
Well, it seems like he wants to wait to see how these negotiations shape up, but he has said that they're a waste of time. So it seems like this is the approach that he is pushing forward, and his advisors have been saying, well, this would be a last resort. It feels like they are kind of at that point. It is really interesting, though, that you mentioned that the president had for the first 2 years of his presidency full control of Congress and still wasn't able to get this done. And, you know, he could have gotten more money for the border wall in a previous package had he not added changes to legal immigration, and that really turned off a lot of folks. It's also really important to note that, you know, we've seen the resistance from Democrats for this wall, but we've also seen some resistance from Republicans. All of the members of the House who represent border districts, including a Republican, say that this wall isn't necessary. So you are getting some pushback there, and you did have some Republicans in states that saw the impact of the federal workforce after the shutdown and don't want to go through that again.
All right. Let's move on to some of the other fireworks in Washington this week. President Trump lashing out at the nation's intelligence agencies, accusing them of being, quote, passive and naive and wrong, saying they should go back to school because they testified before the Senate Intelligence Committee, essentially contradicting him on several foreign policy positions related to Iran, North Korea and ISIS. A day later, the president said the media had fabricated this account, this conflict, and then released a picture of the intel chiefs meeting happily with the president in the Oval Office. Caitlin Huey Burns, what did you see in this back and forth this week?
Well, it's never really a good thing when you feel like you have to have some kind of intervention between the president and his intelligence chiefs. And that's what we are seeing. We should note that the testimony from DNI Dan Coats and others in front of the committee was not only on camera, it was in written testimony, and it was also under oath. So for the president to come back and say that they didn't say that is just untrue. And I think we've also seen, we know from this president, that he has been at odds at many times with the intelligence community on a variety of issues. And coming into this presidency during the campaign, he said things like he knows more than the generals do, and he has always kind of thought that he knows more than those advising him. So that's kind of the pushback that we're seeing. And we also know that this president really likes the headlines. He likes to declare ISIS defeated. He likes to say that everything is fine with North Korea. And here you have his top intelligence officers saying that, well, let's give a little reality check here. Let's talk about what's really going on.
Here is Dan Coats, the Director of National Intelligence, during the annual assessment of global threats. This was on Tuesday before the Senate Intelligence Committee. Coats and his counterparts at the CIA and FBI agreed with one another, but their findings, of course, are at odds with the president's foreign policy decisions. President Trump has said North Korea will dismantle its nuclear program. Here is Dan Coats with a very different take.
We currently assess that North Korea will seek to retain its WMD capabilities and is unlikely to completely give up its nuclear weapons and production capabilities because its leaders ultimately view nuclear weapons as critical to regime survival.
In Syria, President Trump said the Islamic State caliphate has been defeated and the U.S. has started pulling troops out of Syria. Dan Coats warned the threat is still very real.
While we have defeated the caliphate, with a couple of little villages left, we should not underestimate the ability of terrorist groups, particularly ISIS.
Julie Mason, before our break here, what did you make of this quickly?
Well, one of the most overlooked aspects of this is what the intel chiefs said about Iran, Jane. They were saying that Iran is in compliance with the JCPOA, which is a direct contradiction to what the administration has been saying and using as a rationale to ratchet up the bellicosity against Iran.
We're talking about the week in the news. Julie Mason, Caitlin Huey Burns, and Jack Beatty, you can join us. What are your big stories this week? I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. In a recent episode, Series CEO Mindy Luber says sustainability has reached a board level.
Look, if you're an agricultural company and you're not thinking about water risk, you're an apparel company, you're not thinking about risk to your cotton crop around the world. If you are a bank and not thinking about stranded assets of fossil fuels, you're not probably doing your due diligence.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're talking about the week's news, and you can join the conversation. Does the indictment against Roger Stone signal another step closer to the president? Do revelations that Don Jr.'s phone calls after that infamous Russia meeting were not to his father, does that change your view of anything here? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook. We're there at On Point Radio. Great panel today. Julie Mason of SiriusXM, Caitlin Huey Burns of CBS News, and On Point's Jack Beatty. Important news this morning. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announced the U.S. will withdraw from the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces, or INF, treaty, saying that Russia has violated the terms of the Cold War Nuclear Arms Control Treaty, quote, for years without remorse.
For almost 6 years, the United States has gone to tremendous lengths to preserve this agreement and it's just ensure security for our people, our allies, and our partners. We have raised Russia's noncompliance with Russian officials, including at the highest levels of government, more than 30 times. Yet Russia continues to deny that its missile system is noncompliant and violates the treaty.
Julie Mason, your reaction to this?
Well, a couple things, Jane. First, it'll be interesting to see what the Senate has to say about this following their recent rebuke of the president on Syria and Afghanistan. But it's also worth considering, Jane, what a more typical presidential administration would have done with this. It seems to me they would have brought international pressure to bear. They wouldn't have withdrawn from the treaty. They would continue to try to change Russia's behavior. Withdrawing from this treaty is worrisome. And it seems very unusual. I will await international reaction, but seems not good.
So, Caitlin Huey-Burns, this pact has been an arms control focal point since the Cold War. Russia seems to be the impetus here. Russia has been violating this treaty, you know, since 2004, I think, Secretary of State said. How do you view this?
Absolutely. And it has raised questions about whether we are kind of headed back into Cold War era territory. I will say that I was covering the World Economic Forum in Switzerland last week, and Mike Pompeo gave a televised address to the folks there. And he was asked whether the U.S. and Russia were headed again to into a Cold War. There was a lot of concern about U.S.-Russia relations and the future of them. But it's also interesting to consider this kind of pressure that the president himself has been in under Russia, a lot of it under his own making. As we know, the Russia investigation has been hovering over his entire presidency, but he's also taken a very favorable approach to Vladimir Putin. He has met with him without advisors. He has talked very, you know, in kind of put them in good light and has tried to make a relationship with Russia according to his beliefs. And then we've also seen, you know, members of his own administration try to rein that in a little bit and try to put pressure back on Russia with sanctions and other items.
So Jack Beatty is pulling out of the INF treaty to Russia's benefit.
It's hard to say. I really can't say. I don't know enough about it to say.
Do you worry about the implications of this, I guess, is the question.
Yes. Well, the implications are, I think, frightening. I mean, Sam Nunn, the former arms control expert and senator, says this makes everything more dangerous. He draws attention to the shorter time span on short-range missiles. That is to say, if they're fired to 300 miles or 2,500 miles, whatever it might be, there's less time to react, and the chances, therefore, of war by blunder, by, you know, perhaps a mistaken firing or an inadvertent escalation, those chances go up. And it's striking to me that just the prospect of the dissolution of this treaty has caused the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists to keep its doomsday clock at 2 minutes to midnight, which is as close to extinction as it's really been since 1953.
All right. Let's move on now to actions in the U.S. Senate this week. The U.S. Senate advanced a resolution that warned of a precipitous withdrawal from Syria and Afghanistan. It was a rare rebuke by Republicans of President Trump's foreign policy stand. Julie Mason, what did you see on Capitol Hill this week in the Senate?
Such a smackdown, Jane. It was amazing to see the Senate do so many Republicans on board with this, following Mitch McConnell's lead on Syria and Afghanistan, saying, no, President Trump, actually, ISIS is still a threat. Afghanistan is still a mess. We're not doing a precipitous withdrawal. It was interesting to see the Democrats sort of dividing over this. The 2020 Dems were not for it. The calculation there is, well, you know, the rebuke is not worth the cost of endless ongoing wars. So they were against it. But other Democrats were with the Republicans. Now, this is a bit of a clawback of foreign policy control by the Senate. I wouldn't read too much into it, like it's the beginning of the end between Trump and Republicans, but still extremely noteworthy. Mm.
The vote in the Senate was 68 to 23 in favor of this amendment proposed by Senate Majority Leader himself, Mitch McConnell, warning against withdrawing troops from Syria and Afghanistan. Here is Oklahoma Senator James Lankford, Republican, expressing his support for the measure.
We need to make sure that when we withdraw from Syria, when we withdraw from Afghanistan, they're in a posture to be able to transition well. We don't want to happen in Afghanistan and Syria what happened in Iraq. We withdrew too quickly in Iraq. ISIS came about, and there were thousands and thousands of lives lost because of that decision.
Caitlin Huey Burns, McConnell's amendment specifically names al-Qaeda. It specifically names the Islamic State as global threats and salutes the positive role, quote unquote, the positive role that the U.S. and its allies have played in Syria and Afghanistan. And I guess it's really striking, Caitlin, that the Senate Majority Leader himself led this effort.
It is striking because Mitch McConnell is not one who likes to put pit fights against the president. We know that about him, and he has been trying to lead very cautiously the Republican conference in the Senate. But it is striking to note that this is not the first time that the Senate has acted or taken some action in the upper chamber to rebuke Trump in some way on foreign policy. Remember last December, they passed a resolution to stop aid in Yemen that was supporting the Saudis after the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Mm-hmm. So that was also where we were really paying close attention to this alliance. We know that Trump and Republicans have been far apart on foreign policy, you know, since the beginning of his campaign. But why we're starting to pay close attention to it now is because even though the president expanded his majority in the Senate, we're looking to see whether there are any fault lines, any fraying of Donald Trump's coalition in the Senate, because that's going to be critical for not only his 2020 reelection campaign, but also as we get anything else from the Mueller probe, whether these Republicans continue to stick by him. And I also think Julie brings up a really important point about the Democrats who voted against this, who I think that's going to be something really interesting to watch in the 2020 campaign. People like Cory Booker, Kamala Harris, Kirsten Gillibrand all voted against the Republicans on this. Mm. And they're going to be put in a difficult position where they want to rebuke Trump at every turn. But on foreign policy, especially with something like this, they may be more in line with Trump's views.
Well, that's interesting. Jack Beatty, how did you see it?
Well, that is interesting about the Democrats. One doesn't know how foreign policy is going to enter into the Democratic campaign. My guess is it won't play a big role, but it could be an important signaling device. That is, a candidate taking a harder position than the other might be sending a signal to voters that that candidate is more, quote, responsible. We just don't know.
Let's get a call in here from Reed in Salt Lake City. Hi, Reed. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me on.
Go ahead.
I'm just calling just in shock about the, I guess, the bipartisanship. The only thing Mitch McConnell can bring people together is to keep us in war. I'm in my 30s, and we've been in Afghanistan since 2002 when I was a teenager. How many more civilians, innocent children, have to die before we realize that American intervention abroad is not the answer, and it only makes Lockheed Martin and the military-industrial complex richer?
So you support President Trump and his decision to pull troops out?
Someone who doesn't support anything Trump is for, I would actually support him in this. Maybe he's going about it a bit too fast or in the wrong way, but at the same time, you know, how many more decades do we need to be at this endless war with no end in sight?
Reed, thank you. Thank you very much. Julie Mason, your response, you know, a lot of people agree with this assessment.
A lot of people do agree, Jane. One thing it strikes me that's so missing from our public discourse is leaders making the case. You know, this kind of fell off a little bit during the Obama administration, but President Trump has never really made the case. And lawmakers also need to make the case. There needs to be a better public debate about this rather than just like resolutions and furtive mutter to the New York Times. You know, there has to be more discussion so that people can make informed choices about these really important issues.
All right. Let's move on now to Roger Stone, a longtime advisor and confidant of President Trump, pleading not guilty this week to felony charges in the Russia investigation. This is the sixth Trump aide charged in Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation. Caitlin Huey Burns, what did you see here?
Well, Roger Stone is not only a close ally of the president, but has been encouraging Donald Trump to run for the presidency for a while now. And he is a, you know, one of the most recognizable, I think, figures in Trump's orbit. So it's very difficult, I think, for Trump to distance himself from Roger Stone, just given their relationship span goes way back. I think it's also interesting that Roger Stone has not been in hiding. He's actually been the opposite. He's been giving interviews left and right. He's been making lots of public appearances. And I'm kind of wondering what impact that will have as this continues.
Here's one of those interviews. Roger Stone speaking with Laura Ingraham on Fox News. This was Tuesday, the same day he pleaded not guilty to 7 criminal charges of false statements, witness tampering, obstruction of justice. He defended himself against accusations that he lied to congressional investigators.
I'm not going to do what Michael Cohen has done. I'm not going to make up lies or bear false witness against Donald Trump or anyone else. The truth of the matter is that even though I'm accused of lying, when I get Adam Schiff on the stand, when I get Eric Swalwell on the stand, when I get other members of that committee on the stand, I'll demonstrate that they're the ones who are lying, not me.
Jack Beatty, what do you see here? I mean, this indictment does not accuse Stone of coordinating with Russia or with WikiLeaks, but one presumes that there's a lot of electronic evidence and financial records that were collected in that raid of his home, and I suppose that maybe there's more to come on this?
Oh, megabytes, if not more. And in fact, I think the special prosecutor, the Mueller people said, it's going to take us a while to sort through this, and they're going to delay proceedings somewhat on Stone. You know, what's remarkable to me about Stone, and it really isn't remarkable, it's sort of the norm, is why did he lie? Why the lies to Congress? Why the effort to intimidate a witness? Doing this right out in the open. I mean, Michael Cohen also lied to the investigators. Manafort seemed to be, even while he was in prison, seemed to be trying to get involved in witness tampering. Why these extreme what are they covering up that is worth all this drawing to themselves potentially years in prison? I just it is an aspect of this that makes some observers, and there was a fellow from the FBI, a former FBI man on one of the shows recently, think there's something really, really serious here if everybody is lying.
So, Julie Mason, to that point, certainly more legal exposure for Roger Stone. Is this another step closer to the president or not?
Well, Roger Stone may or may not be that ligament that connects the campaign to WikiLeaks. And that's the piece that was missing. That's what everyone is sort of waiting to see if that turns out to be the case. Of course, it was acting AG Whitaker who said very recently that, you know, the Mueller investigation is getting close to wrapping up. But then with the terabytes of information that the FBI gleaned from raiding Roger Stone's properties, you wonder, is that actually the case? He is already waived a speedy trial. They say investigators say it's going to take a very long time to pour through all this information. There could be some sort of superseding indictment, as you allude. It'll be one thing that's really fascinating is President Trump, after the FBI raided Michael Cohen's hotel room, office, storage unit, the president said it was like an attack on our country. It was horrible. It was unspeakable. Now the president hates Michael Cohen, can't say a nice word about him, absolutely loathes the guy. We see kind of the same language with Roger Stone. The FBI going in on Roger Stone's property was like an attack on our country. And you wonder if it's going to follow the same trajectory. Will Roger Stone have a breaking point in the same way that Michael Cohen did? I guess it depends what they have on him.
Let's get a call in here from Richmond, Vermont. Hi, Luke. You're on the air. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thank you for taking my call.
You bet.
I only have probably a not constructive comment, but
okay.
Just take it back to basics real quickly. Any grown person that has a tattoo of Richard Nixon between his shoulder blades has seriously got a problem. And it just outlines, again, how ridiculous this presidency is. And I am cheering for Robert Mueller to finish up. Thank you.
All right, Luke, thank you. Tangentially related, Jack Beatty, CNN reported this week that phone calls made by Donald Trump Jr. after that infamous Trump Tower meeting were not to his father. Democrats have been pointing to that for a long time as potentially a smoking gun. That's a significant development here this week.
It is, and I'm surprised we haven't heard from the White House on that. Maybe I just missed it. I mean, that has been one of the dots that people have connected. Look, who could he have been calling? We know the president has a block number. This was a call to such a number. Must have been telling the president. Apparently not. That doesn't mean that all, you know, all possibility of connection with the Russian collusion is out the window for Mr. Trump by no means. But it is a it shows how careful you have to be in talking about this whole imbroglio. I mean, I've heard journalists just blithely say, "Well, that has to be Mr. Trump." Well, it doesn't have to be, and it wasn't.
Maybe it was Putin.
Caitlin Huey Burns, interestingly, President Trump this week said he would not intervene with the Justice Department's decision-making process about whether to release the report by the special counsel. What do you make of that, the president actually, you know, coming forward and saying that?
Right. Well, that is significant. And we have seen the Justice Department say as much, that they would like to put this out there. But, you know, putting it out there is not the same as putting everything out there. There are ways to keep certain items classified. And so that's why you have Democrats in Congress trying to make their own way in getting this, all of the information out there. So I suspect that even whatever the Justice Department ends up putting out there, I suspect that more that was behind the scenes will come out as well.
We are discussing the week's top headlines here. Julie Mason, host of The Press Pool on SiriusXM's POTUS channel. Caitlin Huey Burns, CBS News digital political reporter. And Jack Beatty, our On Point news analyst. And we'd love to have you with us and join us here. What's top of your mind this week? What's moving your world? I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. In other news this week, Venezuelan's leader Nicolas Maduro addressed Donald Trump in English to demand this week that Washington keep its hands off of his country.
Donald Trump, con Venezuela, no te metas. Hand off Venezuela. Donald Trump, hands off Venezuela.
Hands off Venezuela, Donald Trump. And Grammy-winning R&B singer James Ingram has died at the age of 66. His 1981 song, Just Once, became one of his biggest hits.
Just once, can we figure out what we keep doing wrong? Why we never last for very.
We are talking about the top news this week. You can join the conversation. What's your top story? Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook. We're there at On Point Radio. My guest today, Caitlin Huey Burns of CBS News, Julie Mason of SiriusXM, and On Point's Jack Beatty. All right, a lot of Democrats eyeing the White House. Let's get a tally here. Julie Mason, tell us who's in, who's out as of this week.
Well, Cory Booker is the latest entrant getting into the race. It's fascinating to see who's getting out there in front. Kamala Harris had a great rollout. It's interesting the president refers to her as Camila in that New York Times interview. Still hanging out there in the middle distance, though. Bernie, Biden, and Beto, and also Bloomberg, also waiting to hear from Terry McAuliffe. So the white guys kind of hanging back a little bit.
Democratic presidential candidate Kamala Harris. Here she is speaking with CNN's Jake Tapper. This was at the town hall in Iowa on Monday. She is advocating Medicare for all and the elimination of commercial health insurance. Here she is.
The idea is that everyone gets access to medical care, and you don't have to go through the process of going through an insurance company, having them give you approval, going through the paperwork, all of the delay that may require. Who of us has not had that situation where you got to wait for approval and the doctor says, well, I don't know if your insurance company is going to cover this? Let's eliminate all of that. Let's move on.
And here's former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg speaking to reporters in New Hampshire on Wednesday, voicing his concerns about what she just said, Kamala Harris's Medicare for All proposal.
I think you can have Medicare for All for people that are uncovered, but because that's a smaller group and a lot of them are taking care of Medicaid already, Medicare. To replace the entire private system where companies provide health care for their employees would bankrupt us for a very long time.
That's pretty stark, Caitlin Huey Burns. What did you make of Kamala Harris's proposal there?
Well, what's really interesting about the Democratic primary is that embracing some kind of form of Medicare for All is now a litmus test to get into this race. So it may be that Bloomberg, if he does decide to run as a Democrat in this primary, will be on the fringes of it, at least as healthcare policy is concerned. And I think Democrats would love to hear more from billionaires talking about healthcare because it gives them a convenient punching bag. What Kamala Harris did, though, I mean, several Democrats running for president support a Medicare for All type of approach to health care or some form of it, a Medicare buy-in or a Medicaid buy-in or a public option. And it shows kind of how has shifted politically on healthcare that Democrats are on this point, but also it kind of exposed some perils to embracing such an approach. You know, we saw a poll from the Kaiser Health, the Kaiser Family Foundation, showing that majority support Medicare for All. They love the idea of it, but when you ask them about the details, when you talk about the idea that it may eliminate private insurance, it may affect the Medicare you're already on, it may involve more costs or higher taxes. They seem to take a much more negative approach to it. So this is going to be something that Democrats are going to be debating, especially with healthcare front and center. We saw that in the 2018 campaign. That's not going to change in 2020.
Jack Beatty, what do you make of this? Medicare is an issue here as a litmus test coming up in 2020. I mean, this back and forth between Kamala Harris and Michael Bloomberg saying this is going to bankrupt us if we go this direction. What did you see here?
Well, I think it's a perilous position for Democrats. It's the Bernie position, a recent Gallup poll found that 70% of people with private insurance rated excellent or good, and 85% say that same thing about the health care they receive. The numbers just flip when you tell people they have to give up private insurance. Only 37% favor that, 58% opposed. That's a tough hill to try to persuade people. Trust the government, we'll do it better. Well, people say, I go to my registry of motor vehicles, you're not doing it better there. It's a real perilous position for Democrats to take, as opposed to a gradualist approach. You know, the public option under Obamacare, slowly lowering the age for Medicare. Those sorts of things make sense. This is risky. Mm.
All right. So we've got Kamala Harris. We've got Cory Booker, Bernie Sanders and others here. Also got perhaps Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz entering this race. Democrats criticized him this week, saying that his run may unintentionally help reelect President Trump. To that, Schultz told Scott Pelley on CBS's 60 Minutes on Sunday that if he did decide to run, he would represent all Americans of all parties.
Do you worry
that you're going to siphon votes away from the Democrats and thereby ensure that President Trump has a second term?
I want to see the American people win. I want to see America win. I don't care if you're Democrat, Independent, Libertarian, Republican, bring me your ideas, and I will be an independent person who will embrace those ideas because I am not in any way in bed with a party.
So Julie Mason, I mean, going back to Michael Bloomberg, he criticized Schultz in New Hampshire this week, saying that an independent candidate would essentially hand the election back to Donald Trump.
Yeah. Well, and Bloomberg had looked at an independent run himself and found it not viable. But, you know, it's so funny about Schultz, Jane. I can't even remember someone, you know, thinking about getting into the presidential race who was greeted with such hostility, anger, hair on fire, pushback, screaming at a book event. It's been amazing watching Democrats lose their minds about this. Mm-hmm. It's not an automatic given that he would be a spoiler, although maybe he could be. And also his critiques of the Democratic Party, you know, they are finding some purchase. Maybe they ought to listen to him a little bit.
Let's get some callers in here. Joseph in Lynn, Massachusetts. Hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you very much for taking my call, Jane, and all you people at BUR. I am a visually impaired person. I am for Medicare for all. It can be done right. I need medical attention. I need an implant. I got part of it done. I don't have the $3,000 or $4,000 to pay. Mm-hmm. I want to move into a living assisted. If they can do it in Poland and other countries, they can do it here. I'd like your comments, and I'll take them off the air, and thank you very much.
Joseph, thank you. Let's get somebody else in here on this point. Alex in Baltimore, Maryland. Hi, Alex. You're on the air. What do you think of Medicare for All?
Hi. With a lot of progressive issues, I like the idea in theory. I agree that the system we have leaves too many people behind. However, I grow concerned with the list of progressive candidates, and that seems to be the only way to get elected in the primary these days, that they want it, and, you know, cost be damned, and we're not even going to – we don't really want to talk about the pitfalls of it. And we just want it. And I just think that just concerns me, that's all.
Alex, thank you very much. Julie Mason, I mean, the board lit up when we started talking about Medicare for All. I mean, it is a big issue, and a lot of people care about this.
Well, and Jane, you know, since the Republicans were busily rolling back Obamacare and the Trump administration taking it apart bit by bit, since Trump has come to office, there are 7 million additional uninsured Americans. This is a really big problem with no easy solutions. Of course it resonates. It affects everyone.
Let's get to China this week. President Trump said that trade negotiations with China were going well, but that no final agreement would be reached until he meets with China's president face-to-face, President Xi Jinping. Trump said there was good intention, good spirit on both sides of the talks. Caitlin Huey-Burns, where do we stand on this? It's such an important issue. The back and forth has been contentious at times.
It has, and it's an important issue really for both sides. I mean, China is experiencing really slow economic growth, and so they're concerned about how these trade negotiations will go. And the president knows that. That's where he is seeking leverage here. At the same time, the Chinese know that Trump needs some kind of victory on China and trade. I mean, he has made this centerpiece of his presidential campaign and now of his presidency that his trade policies are better than those that have been in place before him. And so he needs to extract some kind of significant victory here. And especially since this is an issue that really affects his core constituents. I mean, we're talking about those farmers in Iowa, for example, who we've been hearing about from the past several months, really concerned about the uncertainty around these trade deals. They like the president, they trust him, but they're just not sure how this will all pan out. So the economic effect here at home has to be top of mind for the president.
Right. So, Julie, we're talking about a $200 billion increase on these tariffs of Chinese imports. How do you view this? Do you see a breakthrough here?
Well, Jane, I think it's very instructive that the president is sounding very optimistic. He's very excited about the prospects for a deal, saying he may keep some tariffs in place, but he and Xi are really going to work it out. But meanwhile, his own trade rep, Robert Lighthizer, is much more circumspect about the prospects of a deal. They've set a March 2 deadline. He's really trying to tamp down expectations. And usually when the White House does that, you know, we're very skeptical about it. Like, oh, they're just managing expectations so that we'll be wowed by what they come up with. But I think in this case, he really is trying to lower expectations about the prospects of a deal with China.
Jack Beatty, how do you see this? The Justice Department unveiling some sweeping charges against these Chinese telecommunications companies, accusing them of stealing trade secrets. I mean, it was a big deal over there. And some talk that those charges were meant to sort of ratchet up pressure on China before these talks.
I've heard that, and it's the kind of thing the president likes, leverage. But the sort of geostrategic issue, China, the arrangement of the Chinese economy, their industrial policy, their industrial espionage, these are the crucial issues for the future. And there's some fear, you read from analysts, that the president will settle for just a few more soybeans and something else and leave these structural issues aside. For one thing, you can't deal with these structural issues in the time we have. And for another, it's inconceivable in any case that the Chinese would change their basic industrial policy, their national strategy, just to get out of this trade war.
Well, from trade to jobs, and a big story out of Wisconsin this week, the Taiwanese tech manufacturer Foxconn announced on Wednesday that it was reassessing plans to build a $10 billion manufacturing plant in Wisconsin. A Foxconn representative told Reuters that the company would instead build a hub focusing more on research. Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett spoke about the potential change and its impacts to the city's workforce. This was on Wednesday.
Whatever the project changes to transforms into something that's more research oriented, doesn't bode well for those who are underserved in Milwaukee.
President Trump celebrated initially the Foxconn announcement as a major jobs deal. It was supposed to bring 13,000 manufacturing jobs to Wisconsin, paying an average, Julie Mason, of about $53,000 a year. What does this say about, you know, the president's promise, sort of his ongoing promise to bring more manufacturing jobs back to the United States?
I know, yet again, putting the con in Foxconn, Foxconn job. It's not even clear if this was a direct bait and switch, but man, this company got so many concessions from the state. They got infrastructure, they got tax deals. They just got billions of breaks in this. And the president at one point called it the eighth wonder of the world and really touted it as an exemplar of his own great acumen. He was bringing jobs back to the country. The White House really has not had much to say about Foxconn in the last few days. But what an epic bomb.
It was hard news for those folks in Wisconsin, Caitlin Huey Burns, who were hoping for these jobs, these well-paying, high-paying jobs.
Absolutely. And the president liked to talk about Wisconsin very fondly when he talks about his presidential victory. And this was really centerpiece of his pitch for the presidency and in the early goings of this administration. And, you know, now that we're kind of in the throes of the 2020 presidential campaign, Democrats are trying to figure out how to appeal back to those states and to those voters that they lost for Trump. And there's some evidence, this included, that those voters could be up for grabs if they can effectively make the case that Trump made these promises and wasn't able to keep them. But there's also the reality beyond politics of things like automation and other things that are pushing and changing the workforce in a way. And it's been very difficult for leaders on both sides to make that case effectively to voters. Mm-hmm.
Well, big news from the Federal Reserve this week. The Fed signaling that its march toward higher interest rates may be ending sooner than expected. We had U.S. hiring in January topping all forecasts, U.S. payrolls rising by about 300,000. So more good economic news, Julie Mason.
There is, but there are some warning signs underneath. We talked about China trade earlier, and of course, the trade war between these two countries has slowed down the economic, the Chinese economy and the U.S. economy, and that's creating fears about the global economy, like a global recession. Economists still warning that we are due for a recession coming up. That's a real worry point for the Republican Party, especially as we head into 2020. Some of the underlying factors are not great.
Can't forget the polar vortex, Caitlin Huey Burns, before we get out of here today. Millions, not funny really, across the Midwest experienced just these freezing temperatures, Arctic temperatures, 50 degrees below zero. It was something else, Caitlin.
Absolutely. And I'm sitting here in New York with my snow boots on, ready to head outside. But I do feel for those in Chicago and elsewhere, these temperatures being compared to colder than Antarctica and all of these other images that we're seeing are quite startling and raise a lot of questions about the effects of climate change.
Yeah, we're with you there in the Midwest. Take care. Thanks very much. A great panel today. Lots of important topics to get to. Julie Mason, host of the Press Pool on Sirius XM's POTUS channel. Great to have your perspective. Julie, thanks.
Thank you, Jane.
Caitlin Huey Burns, CBS News digital political reporter. Caitlin, thank you.
Thank you.
And On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. Jack, thanks. Have a great weekend.
Thank you, Jane.
And listeners, as always, thank you. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Mindy Luber, CEO of Ceres, a nonprofit dedicated to integrating sustainability into businesses. Here's host Kurt Nickisch.
Are the people who are working with ESG data now at companies, are they in a sustainability department? Does this just become part of general strategy or part of finance? How is that evolution happening with the actual people who are looking and working with the numbers?
So with both companies and investors, the cute idea of social responsibility that was at a manager level or something their foundations dealt with, that's gone. It is very clear based on data, based on facts, based on trends, that integrating sustainability into the core business is crucial. I mean, you cannot have a climate goal that says we're going to get to a net zero by 2040 if every department at the enterprise is not working on that. That's your manufacturing people. It's your supply chain people. So we find that there is often a sustainability team, but they're laying out a plan that involves almost every enterprise, every office, every part of a firm. And that's what we're seeing because nobody can do the kind of cross-organizational work in one little group. It involves the entire team. It involves HR. Who are you hiring? Is DEI being implemented? How is that working? As it relates to where do you get your resources? Are there enough natural resources to make your product? What are the auto companies doing now that they've committed to by 2035, there will be no combustion engine vehicles coming off their assembly line for consumer vehicles? So sustainability is no longer a cute, a niche, a part of something off to the side. It is an integral part of almost every major enterprise and every major investor.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.